Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is September 20th. We have today Peter Buchvar and Ira Harris. Peter is the Chief Investment Officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory. He also has a great Substack platform. It offers great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003 and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Richard, Ira, great to be with both of you.
Yeah, this is a great pleasure. Lots of stuff to discuss. So, Richard, you're on.
Yeah, great. Peter, how do you view the current global macro environment and your perspective on the financial markets currently?
Extraordinarily confusing. Okay. There is no one consistent theme here. And that is with individual country economies and economies with each one of those individual countries. You have areas of growth, you have areas of contraction, you have areas of malaise, and I think it's all coming together in this very sort of confusing situation. And, you know, then you overlay that to political and geopolitical issues that we need to think about, how central banks are now pivoting in response, and, you know, everyone believing that, you know, the inflation boogeyman has been slayed and it's all clear green light from here, and central banks have now the free rein to respond to any further economic weakness. I just don't think the world is that easy. I think anybody who is sort of working with the playbook from pre-2022 or even pre-2021 before inflation really got going, I just don't think that same playbook is going to work so well this time around. I know I was very vague there and not very detailed, but I just wanted to throw that out there to start.
No, that makes sense. It's quite difficult. A lot of moving parts happening, a lot of change. What are your thoughts, Ira?
Well, we're in this realm. We saw what the Fed did. We're trying to understand what the Fed did. Certainly the Bank of Japan, and Peter wrote about it beautifully this morning. There was no surprises there, because why roil the markets? But we'll get into it. But what we're steeped in, and I think that's where Peter goes, is, you know, anybody who's just focused on the economy is missing a lot. I joked about it, because yesterday Peter wrote a beautiful piece with one of my favorite pieces of music, Bruce Springsteen, and he's a Jersey guy, so, you know, it's easy for him to write, but. Yeah. You know, had me singing all day.
Okay.
But they wrote him a note putting together certain Springsteen songs. But I was thinking about that. So today, I believe that Peter and I, we're going to go into the realm of Stevie Miller, and we're going to talk on the pompousness of political economy, taking from one of Stevie Miller's great lines, on the pompousness of love. We're going to speak on the pompousness of political economy, because that's where we're at. The Fed's decision, was it political as much as economic? I don't know. Certainly the Bank of Japan is, because they're in political season too, with a big election coming up, I believe, on the 27th of September. So again, here we are. And to throw that out even further, a huge election this Sunday in Germany, in Brandenburg. This bears great watching, but yet, you know, everybody in America is more concerned about it, who writes in the media, especially financial, you know, 25 or 50, 25 or 50, 25 or 50. it became a sideshow, but there's so much more going on. So I guess we're going to get right into it.
So for the viewers that didn't know my Bruce Springsteen reference, it was from Blinded by the Light. The instruction to Bruce was take a ride at the light, go straight into the night, and then boy, you're on your own. And I think that's what we're all doing here is even the Fed and all these central banks, we're sort of in this hall of mirrors, just trying to figure things out because nothing really is clear right now.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you make, Peter, of the Fed announcements, actions, and the wording this week?
So I you know, to Ira's point about 25 or 50, I think it was just a reason to talk about things, because going into the meeting, when you're pricing in the Fed funds futures market, 100 basis points of cuts over the three meetings pre the announcement into year end, and then another 100 plus next year, who cares if they were going to cut 25 or 50 when you've priced in 200 basis points of cuts already over the next 12 months? It was irrelevant. And I know the market got itself into such a tizzy, but what we've seen is that, yeah, the short end has fallen a few basis points from where it was just before that announcement, 5 basis points we're talking, but the 10-year yield's actually higher. So we're getting actually sort of in a way, a bear steepening in that long rates. So that's a thing that is going to make people's heads explode, because there was this belief the Fed's going to cut interest rates and everything is going to be fine across the yield curve. But it depends on where across that yield curve you're going to borrow from. If you are a SOFR plus borrower, well, then you're going to celebrate these cuts in interest rates overnight. But if you are in real estate and you are pricing your loan off, or your lender is pricing the loan off the 5-year, or even the, you know, more likely the 10-year, well, your cost of capital just went up. It's certainly down from its peak, but it hasn't changed from where it was last summer. Last summer, it was around 3.75. Then the Bank of Japan got rid of yield curve control and then went to 5. So we're just back to where we were last summer when the Fed funds rate was higher than it is after this rate cut. So that's the sort of fly in the ointment here, is that anybody who is a borrower here said the Fed's cutting rates, you know, I'm going to get saved here. It's much more nuanced. And if the market thinks that the Fed is just declared victory over inflation, they're going to get complacent, and the only focus now is the unemployment rate, and they get too aggressive with the cuts because they're so insensitive to that rate. Well, what happens if the dollar, which has already rolled over and will continue to roll over, what happens if that reignites commodity prices and reignites in goods inflation, which goods has been the area where there's been the most disinflation? Well, if now you're going to encourage the purchase of goods via any big ticket item where you would take out a loan that is influenced obviously by where both short rates and loan rates are, you know, you can just, I'm not saying it happens that we get a repeat of the 1970s, but we're getting a repeat of this sort of same psychology where you had the late 60s, early 70s rise in inflation, central bank tightens, inflation falls, then you throw in the mix of wage and price controls, and then everyone thinks that everything is fine, only to have a reacceleration of inflation. And it took a lot for central bankers, and I say central bankers generally because we're seeing cuts in the Bank of Canada and the ECB, of course, the BOE, even though they didn't cut after the initial one. The psychology is still the same. Like, human nature never changes in that they feel like everything is fine now. They've slayed it. And that was the same thought process in the 70s. Now, I grant that the economy warranted probably some rate cuts. Take the edge off this very sharp rise in interest rates that we've seen. And we still have rates well above zero still. And everyone can debate what the proper real rate is. So I'm fine with some rate cuts. I just think that the Fed just has to be very careful with this sort of dance in their shifting of focus. And I understand their shift of focus. They don't want a recession, and Powell doesn't want a 5% unemployment rate. I understand all this. But it's just not going to be this clear path. Getting back to my Bruce Springsteen line, it's, you know, but the markets seem to think that everything is fine and that Fed has license, and, you know, with the stock market at record highs here, they're obviously pretty confident in the Fed. Meanwhile, on the ground economic data and all the anecdotes that I hear from not just corporate America, but from everywhere, whether it was Mercedes talking about China or Skechers citing China as well, or Germany's economy that's essentially at best flatlining, most likely in a recession, is that there are serious economic challenges out there, and for a variety of reasons. And, you know, on one hand, you know, the stock market thinks that that'll all get resolved by rate cuts, but I think it's going to be more complicated than that.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Good points. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, yeah, that's certainly where we're at. And when we come to Germany, I mean, yesterday, the German DAX was making all-time highs. And the news out of Europe, especially Germany and Germany especially, but Germany's the most critical of them all, but yet the DAX is making highs. Now, it's not doing it because of interest rates. You know, we'll probably get into it, but Draghi last week or 2 weeks ago issued that huge research on why Europe has to go into a massive fiscal stimulus in order to catch up to China and the U.S. are not left behind. So, that factors into it. Now, the DAX is getting beat up pretty good today, early. Again, it's early and coming off those highs, but it was still an interesting chart to look at. But let's go back to the Fed for a minute, because I've been perplexed, and I've talked about it with Peter, and I've talked about it in several podcasts. I've never understood throughout these last 6 months how Powell was able to get a unanimous vote at every meeting. Now, yes, we know this one wasn't unanimous. And by the way, the media projected it wrong, because there have been negative votes, but they've come from regional presidents, not from governors. And governors, by definition and by their job description, have more influence because they vote on certain things that regional presidents don't have to vote on. So this was the first one with Mickey Bowman. Michelle Bowman, I shouldn't call her Mickey, I don't know her well enough, but Michelle Bowman, you know, dissented because she only wanted 25. But I'm left in, and here we come back to the theme of political economy, because I've been amazed that what I call the Biden four, his appointees as governors, have fallen in line and voted to maintain rates at where they were, five and a quarter, five and a half. Because when they speak, for the most part, they speak very dovishly after the meeting, in between meetings. So why were they not voting that? Now I'm almost convinced that they were waiting. The deal was to wait until the February, that they get what they wanted, a half point cut. Because I don't understand why they didn't cut a half point at July 31st. Made no sense to me. The SOM rule gave them cover, and the coming election gave him cover, and he could have taken out an insurance policy saying, look, it, the job market is softening. We know that. We're going to cut 50 now, and I've said it very openly several times on these podcasts with Daniel Calle and Tom
DeLongo.
Yeah, and you know that if I was running the Fed, I'd be cutting and say, this is what you're going to see until November or December, and we're getting out of the way. We don't want to be deemed political. But they timed this as such. So was that the buy-off that Powell said, well, if the unemployment numbers, that we'll go the half? Because Waller got, usually for Chris Waller, he got pretty dovish also following upon Powell's speech at Jackson Hole. So I'm every day that goes by, I'm more convinced that was the deal. And it was okay. And it was good that Michelle Bowman dissented. It gave it even more credibility. But interestingly, when the Fed was in their dark period, meaning that there's no speeches X amount of days before the Fed meeting, we had some heavy hitters come out. Mohamed El-Erian came out and they were calling for a bigger cut. Dudley again, but Dudley called for that in July, so that was nothing new. But he called for a 50 basis point cut. And then, of course, we had the three from the Senate led by Elizabeth Warren calling for 75 basis points one day ahead of the actual. So there was a lot of political cover to this. And there were other people calling for 50 basis points. And to me, that was, you know, no big deal. So much so that became the major theme. So the more I think about this, this was political. But they may have made a gigantic error. So they were hoping to get the news of it and maybe equity markets to perform certain ways, although you can never be assured of that. But I thought Trump's criticism of it, because he cut it both ways too. He said, you know, and he went to where he should have gone, which is, does this signal that the economy is as soft as basically I've been saying it is, softer than we think, and that's why they're moving? Or was this political? And again, it threw them right into this. So this is where we're at. And I thought the bond, as Peter talks about, I thought what the yield curves did, and Peter and I have discussed this on air and off air, the yield curves did exactly what they were supposed to. And Powell kept talking about, he talked about two things. And I was glad Nick Timiraos actually came up with it and talked about it yesterday, which was, and Peter just brought it up, talking about recalibration. That's the new word. And it's the recalibrating. They can recalibrate. So recalibrating to lifting and ensuring that employment doesn't drop as dramatically as we've seen in the past. But Paulo also made 2, 3, 4, 5 references to the people we serve, to the people we serve, to those who we... So he was back in what I call his role as the Minister of Justice. But I am careful of that, because I would say that the people they serve right now, meaning the Fed, is to try to get interest rates down to get the cost of the deficit. Because again, nobody's talking about the deficit. Few people are, it shows up, but the mainstream media, and because Powell and Kamala Harris are both reticent, because they both bear a lot of responsibility for the explosion in the debt. So they stay away from it. But when you look at those numbers, we're at some very serious numbers, the cost of carrying this and financing this deficit. So the lower the Fed can go, again, if we're approaching neutral, how we recalibrate, say, how low they go is a significant budget saving. It's a budget item for the cost of interest for carrying this deficit. So I thought the bond market did exactly what they did. Is the yield curve going to go straight up? No, it doesn't do that, and it won't do that. There are still a lot of people who are talking about extending duration. For me, there's not a chance I go out more than 2 years, and 2 years is a push because the markets have already moved so dramatically. And as Peter's talked about ad nauseum in his letters, when the 10-year got down to 355, 360, where do you think it was going? Even if the Fed dropped rates to 3.5%, where do you think the 10-year is going to go? Because I ran recently the 200-month moving averages on the 210 curve, and over, you know, and that's all just mean reversion work. But the 200-day moving average is 120 basis points positive. So we could go down to 3.5 on the overnight rate, and we can have 10s go to 470. And we would be in the realm of what is deemed a healthy treasury market. So I'll stop there, but you see where.
You mentioned the yield curve, Ira. I'm just wondering, Peter, your thoughts. This is the 10-year, 2-year spread. These charts are provided graciously by Judd Hirschberg of White Wave Trading. And just wondering your thoughts on this, Peter.
So I'm worried that the 10-year yield after this come down to, like I said, that last sort of June, July levels, we're going back up again. And so we'll get steepening because the Fed will probably continue to cut short-term interest rates. But outside of it being an economic indicator of some sort, it also shows that rate cuts are just not necessarily going to save the day, because it all depends on where on that curve you're going to borrow from. Residential real estate buyers, if the 10-year yield goes back to 4%, did they benefit from the cut in the Fed funds rate? No. Only will they if the spread between treasuries and mortgage-backed securities narrows, that can offset a rise in the absolute long-end yield. But this is a much trickier game that the Fed is trying to maneuver through here. And that's what I have my eye on. I mean, to speak big picture, you know, we had a 40-year bond bull market, as we all know. The bear market doesn't end in just 2 years in bonds, 3 years. We had an epic bond bubble with $18 trillion of negative yielding securities. And the thing that's not spoken of, as everyone focuses on the cost of money, no one's focusing on the quantity of money. And the quantity of money has been shrinking. The Fed, the ECB, the BOE, the BOC, the RBA, and even the Bank of Japan is reducing the pace of their asset purchases. There is global QT that continues to move on, irrespective of where the short-term interest rates are going at these individual banks. And that seems to have gotten lost in the conversation, and why I think there's still a lot of risk to the upside as these banks work through this process, that you get a rise in long-term interest rates. Then you throw in worries about U.S. debts and deficits, which I want to touch upon in a second. And then you throw in the possibility of further dollar weakness that can reignite in import prices and commodity price inflation. And all of a sudden, the Fed's got an issue again. Now, with respect to debts and deficits, you know, to me, the knee-jerk reaction was, okay, well, if the market finally cared after never caring, and people were talking about debts and deficit issues in the 1980s that never ended up mattering, my knee-jerk reaction was, okay, it'll show up in the treasury market, and who's going to want to buy U.S. treasuries, and we'll have a failed auction, blah, 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 and loan rates would go up. But, you know, over the past month, watching the action in the dollar, I began to think that just maybe those worries about the finances of the U.S. government is first reflected in the value of the U.S. dollar, and that the dollar has weakened because, yes, the Fed is cutting, but outside of the BOJ, other central banks are cutting too. The Fed's not the only one. So maybe there's something more deeper than just interest rate differentials. The Singapore dollar is not at a 10-year high against the U.S. dollar just on an interest rate differential trade. There's something deeper here, and maybe it's because the Singaporean government's budget deficit, even though it's a city-state of only about 6 million-ish people, is about 0.5% versus the budget deficit as a percent of GDP in the U.S. at 6%, even before a recession. So I'm thinking that maybe this expression of worries about the U.S. Gets reflected in the dollar. And maybe this whole BRICS currency diversification, where the Chinese are buying oil from the Saudis in yuan instead of dollars, and they're buying corn and soybeans from Brazil and in yuan for maybe that, you know, that's part of this too, and the rally in gold is part of this too, and that is where, at least right now, these worries are getting expressed. And then will it at some point show up in the U.S. Treasury market? I think so. But first in the currency markets and gold, I believe it is.
Yeah, that's a great global perspective. Peter, your thoughts, Ira, in conjunction with all the currencies and commodities, precious
metals?
I don't
have anything to add. And a lot of people are bullish the dollar, especially because we saw the dollar action. So first you saw the dollar down, right, for about a half an hour. And I would tell you, everything we saw on Wednesday, the action was contravention to what we see on every previous meeting where they held. Because what would happen? The gold would break during the price conference. And by the end of the day, the gold would turn around and rally again. The dollar, same thing. You get a little saw, and then it would turn around and rally. The equities, same thing. Break and then wind up closing. How many times in those meetings it closed on its highs? Quite a bit. So this time, totally different. The gold rallied to all-time highs on Wednesday and broke $50 before the 4 o'clock close in Chicago on Globex. It broke $50 from high to low and closing on the low. Totally different. And that was on a rate cut. So people got nervous saying, well, this is all in the market already. Well, we see there's a lot of dissonance. And I think that's what Peter picks up, is the dissonance. The dollar really hasn't done much. We're still sitting here. Where are we at? Par 94. It's tested, again, the 200-week moving average pretty consistently. And let's see, actually on the week, let's just take a quick gander. The dollar is actually a little bit lower for the week. Yes, the yen is softer, but that's to be expected. The bank did nothing. And we'll get, and the yen had such a significant quick run that we're getting, that's what markets do. They correct. How high will it go to? Will it go back to 147, 148 on dollar yen? I don't know. But for the week, the dollar still is lower. So Peter catches, what is it? Now, is it lower because of the debt? I happen to agree with Peter. I think the debt is the quiet. It's quiet because we're in election season. But it's for people who are a little bit nervous about where this goes, because it's not about November 6th. It's now about November 8th, because who wins? And the way that they deal with that debt is going to be how these markets play out. But I think that just to cite him, Ambrose Evans Pritchard made a really good point that also besides helping the Treasury and Congress by lowering rates to make the cost of funding the deficit less, and half point is nothing, we're going to have to go further. It also relieves pressure on the emerging market world, who is so heavily borrowed up in dollars. You know, that was the problem when the dollar was up at 110, 112 on the dollar index. The global economy was choking because the cost of financing that debt with expensive dollars and higher interest rates was a two-pronged thing that was really causing problems. I mean, now we're going to hear, and I'll stop after this, but we're going to hear what the neutral rate is, our star. This is now going to become, as they recalibrate, what are they recalibrating to? So they have room. And I'm a real yield person. It's a big part of the way I analyze global markets is through real yields and what they mean. But going forward, this is going to be a very important issue. And I think Peter's got that dead right on target.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And Peter, you mentioned the 1970s, and given what Ira just mentioned on the pressure of the US dollar on emerging markets, but having a tendency to get better if the US dollar gets weaker, plus the debt challenges you mentioned. Do you foresee a potential for rhyming of the 1970s where we sort of go sidelined on equities or assets in general, but nominally, but in real terms, we go much lower? So like in real terms, inflation adjusted or gold priced, what are your thoughts on that? Yeah.
I mean, it is very possible. I think the inflation debate, you know, is looked at, you know, somewhat narrowly in the sense of, you know, inflation spikes, comes back down again. And when it comes back down, people just assume that the war has been won. The war is only won when inflation sustainably stays down. Because, and we hope that it does. We hope that we sort of can get down to the 1 to 2% level and stay there. And that was what happened in the 70s, where it did not on those numbers, but it came down and didn't stay there. So I hope it does, but my eyes and ears are open for it not. And I say that not just in empty speculation, but when you look at CPI, to use that as an example, we know that housing is the biggest component and rental. Keep in mind, if CPI included home prices instead of rents, in 2022, inflation would have been well into the double digits. Powell's lucky that it calculated only rents and not home prices. Home prices have been up about 50% since around COVID. Rents are only up about 25%. So now that we have the Fed cutting interest rates, what does that do to the housing market? Well, my initial reaction is, if it spurs demand and we're not seeing this big pickup in supply, now maybe it does elicit supply because people can say, okay, well, now I can tolerate the current mortgage rate. But what happens if mortgage rates actually go back up again when the Fed's cutting short rates, as we discussed earlier? We'll have to see. I'm watching closely to see how this plays out. But if we get a spur of demand and not enough inventory, then home prices will continue to go higher. Now, getting back to rents, which flows into the inflation stats, we are seeing a record number of multifamily units being delivered this year. So rental growth is going to continue to slow, will continue to show up in CPI, even though it's barely done it so far, but will. And inflation in the back half of this year and into early part of 2025 on the services side is going to continue to decelerate because of rents. But we've seen a very sharp decline in new incremental multifamily starts, shovels in the ground, because deals don't pencil out like they did pre-2022. So now we're sowing the seeds after this deceleration in rents for an acceleration of rents in the back half of 25 into 2026. So that gets back to the possibility of a reacceleration of inflation, just as you can be sure over this time, the Fed is going to be continuously cutting interest rates. So you do see the possibility of a repeat in some way of that, but this plays out over a multi-year time frame. It's not just inflation rises, it falls, and it spikes back up again. This is a multi-year thing of playing out. Now, with respect to nominal versus real returns, that's a possibility because, number one, you have valuations in the U.S. market that's very high, but you can say that, you could have said that for a while, and markets continue to do well, but they're still high. They're still trading at, I think, 22 times, actually 24 times 2023 numbers and 21 times 25. So that's pulled forward future returns. And I think very importantly for the stock market, which we have to ask ourselves, is the AI tech trade, which we know dragged so much of the market with it, has that played out in terms of their outperformance relative to other parts of the market? And I think it has. And I say that because investors are now finally asking the tough questions of, okay, hyperscalers, you're going to spend $15 to $17 billion a quarter, and it's time to, you know, show me the money. NVIDIA is the one that's receiving all the money, and that's why their business continues to be robust. But even NVIDIA, people are questioning, okay, is 76% profit margin sustainable? And no, it's not in a cyclical business. So that means that the market needs to pass the baton on to other parts of the market, which it has. The S&P over the past month plus is outperforming the NASDAQ. But the question is whether that's sustainable. I hope it is, because we own a lot of that other stuff too. But that then ties into what does the economy do? If it continues to slow, well, that's going to be a drag on earnings. And so I guess to answer your question, yeah, there is a good possibility that we pulled forward a lot of future returns, and that nominal returns will be pretty mediocre for the next 5+ years as we sort of grow into current earnings. And that on a real basis, assuming inflation continues to go up, as it always does, just the rate of change that we debate, that real returns will suffer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it also is aligned with the idea of keeping inflation for a long period of time to help reduce the burden of the debt. Like if you have 4% inflation for 10 years, if you do the math, it comes out to maybe half the burden is reduced of the debt. What are your thoughts, Ira, on that?
Can I just say one thing to that, Richard?
Yes.
You know, on paper, that sounds so easy, right? But in reality, if you have sustainable 4% inflation, you're going to have sustainably much higher interest rates, and you're going to hurt the economy, which will hurt tax receipts, and we'll have even more debt that the Treasury needs to issue. And we'll have not just a $1 trillion interest expense burdens, it'll be even greater than that. So that is sort of the offset to, oh, let's just inflate our way out of all this debt.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. Yeah, and your thoughts, Ira, do you think we'll get a repeat
1966? I mean, we're sitting here on the Financial Repression Authority, which is the basis of this whole discussion. I mean, it's so aptly named because that's it. Financial repression is a policy choice. So, and Rogoff and Reinhart, when they wrote This Time Is Different, they did all that research, and you know, so much of it came off of Carmen Reinhart's work on financial repression after World War II and how to get that debt under control. So, I mean, they said very openly, you know, if you, you know, Rogoff was out there, you know, sustaining the argument, well, if you can get 4 to 6% inflation over, you know, a period of time, like you could control that. So Peter's 100% right. And if you keep real rates negative, yeah, you know, without harming anybody. And remember when we started down this road with the Bernanke doctrine, right? And let's go back to what. And so we're talking about financial repression, and that was the policy. It was a determination, because even Keynes, and I've been reading his book, Tract on Monetary Reform, wrote in 1923, in looking at what Europe was doing, he was very adamant about it. The power of the, you know, basically the political debtors is powerful. And in this time, you're talking about the government. So when everybody was talking about, we go back to the 70s, the 70s have nothing to do with this, in my opinion. Why? Because as people said, well, Powell needs to find his inner Volcker, right? That's what we were hearing when the forecast on transitory inflation proved so wildly wrong. Now he's got to find his inner Volcker. But again, the debt to GDP ratio was 39%. Had Volcker lived with 105%, 110%, whatever the number is, there's no way he could have done what he did, because he would have broke the back of the entire global financial system. That was obvious. You could do it at 39. You cannot do it. So what are the outcomes? And is that what gold is telling us? Because again, gold, in my mind, fundamentally is terribly mispriced. Looking at the concept of real yields and what they mean, because real yields are usually very detrimental to the gold market. This time they have not been. We have not seen the type of correction that we saw, because we saw that correction in 1980. So, when Volcker did what he had to do to begin the path on the break of inflation, gold saw it right away. We went from 880 all the way down to 360 to 400 over that path. He did not happen here. There is something mandatorily different. And that's because the US, and even Rogoff, who did a recent interview with this Swiss group, I've never heard him so caustic about this situation. Because you know what? Everybody's turned, you know, we're in an area of benign neglect, like it's going to go away. It's not going to go away. But the question is, and how you make your investments, is how this comes to resolution. If we go to negative real yields, the gold is 100% right, the equities are priced right, and the steepener will return to its historic mean of 120 to 150, maybe more. If I ask you this question, we're over the last, let's see, we've been in the, you know, the great financial crisis and coming out of it, where do you think the yield was on the second QE? Where do you think the 210 curve, and I'm doing this from memory, I'm not looking at a chart, but I was just looking at this with Angelo Gallo, very bright guy, another fan of Bruce Springsteen, but we were looking at it. And if I asked you on the second bout of QE, I think it was February of 2010, where do you think the 210 went with the second announcement of QE?
290. Well, I know each the first Q1, QE1 and QE2.
Yeah.
Rates actually went up.
Right.
Long rates went up because people thought the Fed is now inflating.
Right.
So counterintuitively, they said we're going to try to suppress long-term interest rates by buying treasuries, but treasuries actually sold off and yields went higher.
That curve, the 210 went out to 290 positive. So, you know, you have to put that into context, because what was the market afraid of? That, hey, we're going to negative real yields because they have to battle the fear of deflation, because that's what that was all about. You know, Bernanke is, and his whole academic research was on the deflationary period in the 30s and especially 37. But when we get to this, it's really important to pay attention to this, because again, we're in, how do they, the question is, how do you resolve the issue? If you do it through taxation, then the equity markets are way overpriced. If you use taxation, which is, by the way, what modern monetary theory as put forward by Warren Mosler discusses, that an enlightened electorate will vote to raise its taxes to slow the economy, right? From all that monetary stimulus. That's what an enlightened, and that's what they talk about. But if that's not what we're doing here, and because we can't, again, if we're going to bail the debtor out, and the debtor in this case is the United States government, a massive debtor, how are you going to do it? And what's the resolution? And that's what's going to lead us to profitable investments.
And what are your thoughts, Peter, on that for profitable investments, different generic asset classes? Do you like gold, precious metals? What do you see as the drivers of that as well, based on what Ira mentioned on gold also?
Yeah, so we've been bullish and long gold and silver, but that's nothing new. I've ridden a lot of the ups and downs. I do think that there's further upside, particularly in silver. You know, getting back to the whole idea of the dollar reflecting the concerns that foreigners have with the U.S. government, you know, that's reflected in all the central bank buying of gold. In addition to, of course, that we froze half of Russia's central bank reserves, and that also triggered different behavior on the part of central banks in terms of how they wanted to structure the complexion of their FX reserves and more into gold. I do think that central banks around the world outside of the BOJ are now trying to sort of draw a line under what they see is weak economic growth. And I do think that commodities after this pullback. I think commodities are still in an aggregate bull market. And you know, one of the most interesting charts, and I know you've had Adam Rosenzweig on your show. He's a friend of mine, and in his quarterly letter for Q2, he had this amazing chart of going back to 1900. Because prior to seeing this chart, I've only seen this chart going back to the 70s, but they somehow created a proprietary inflation index, and they did a ratio chart of the Dow versus commodities. And outside of the late 60s, or I should say mid 60s, commodities have never been this cheap relative to stocks. So we're still biased to not just precious metals, but energy stocks, uranium. And our recent purchases have been in the ag space, particularly fertilizers. But you know, over the last couple of years, when there's been this wide chasm between growth stocks and value, there's been a lot of left for dead cheap value stocks that we are that we own and we find very attractive. Also, you know, anybody who's listened to me, I like investing internationally, and I continue to find cheap stuff overseas, particularly in London and also in parts of Asia.
Which parts of Asia would you also invest in? Hong Kong?
I find some cheap stuff there. We were long stocks in Singapore, and so I've been long Vietnam stocks for a while, and they've just been terrible. Something to watch though is the Vietnamese government just recently made an announcement in sort of changing how some of their capital markets work that can qualify the Vietnamese stock market, the Ho Chi Minh Index, into some of these emerging market indices that can bring in fresh money into that market. So, you know, I the way that I view the world is, you know, we tend to look at it, you know, in terms of from an investing perspective that, you know, everything emanates from the U.S. And hey, we're the most dominant economy for sure. So I understand it. But, you know, over the next 10 years, the U.S. GDP will continue to shrink as a percentage of the global GDP pie. And who will get more slices of that pie is going to be Asia, including China. I mean, you know, China's still an interesting middle, you know, a middle class growth story. But that's where more slices in terms of GDP growth are going to go to. And that's half the world's population. So now you can buy US companies that are going to benefit from that. And we look at that as well, and we own some. But I think that if I'm right that the US big cap tech trade has sort of played out in terms of its dominance, and that has triggered a dominance in terms of US market cap relative to global market cap and relative to its GDP, that maybe it's time and maybe a mean reversion where other equity markets and other economies can gain a bigger piece of that pie. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think people should be looking at from an investment perspective when looking at over a 5 to 10 year time frame. Talk yes. big.
Well put, yeah, well phrased. And your thoughts, Ira, on that for investment?
Well, you know, it's, my wife laughs every time she listens to Peter. She goes, "Yeah, what are you two tied at the hip? You know, but you don't talk to me anymore. You only talk to Peter." So, yeah, there's so much of that. You know, Peter does far better at the bottom up. I look at the world top down. So that's where we'll merge. And I see Asia is very interesting to me. I thought, and you know, going back to the political economy, you know, from last night's BOJ release, what Ueda said was so ambiguous. Because he, at the end, this is, and even Naomi Fink, who I have a lot of respect for, they quote her in the FT today talking about this, that all of a sudden the BOJ talked about the global situation, the, you know, alluding to the currency, but not really talking much about the currency, but Naomi really brought it to the attention. But there's this paragraph in here. It's the last paragraph. concerning risk outlook on the overseas economic activity and prices, developments in commodity prices, and domestic firms' wage and price setting behavior. Under these circumstances, it is necessary to pay due attention to developments in financial and foreign exchange markets and their impacts on Japan's economic activity and prices. In particular, with firms' behavior shifting more towards raising wages and prices recently, exchange rates developments are, compared to the past, more likely to affect prices. Now, to me, that's ambiguous, because what does that say? Do you need a stronger yen to curtail the impact of higher import prices affecting the recent raises in wages? Because this is not the model of Japan as the mercantilist center of the world, where they use an undervalued currency to propel their exports. This is a really ambiguous statement. Now, I know the dollar yen went higher because they didn't do anything, but there was no way the Bank of Japan was going to do anything last night. So I would tell you, and I'm going to promote my son because he does great work. He is a political economist, and his understanding of Japanese politics is second to none. Pay attention over the next, because the different people who, there are nine people vying for the LDP position to replace Kishida, but some are actually very bullish, want to be bullish yen, because they think a weak yen has been a detriment to the Japanese middle class. And this statement from Ueda is very ambiguous about that. So he's probably waiting to see who takes the reins, because he's going to, you know, they're not as independent as everybody wants to believe. So that, again, that's on the Asian. And China is, again, an interesting story. I don't think China is nearly as weak as others. And what tells me that? The Australian dollar. And the fact that the RBA is not moving to lower rates dramatically. So if China was slowing dramatically, I would look to Australia. But then I go, and to me, the most interesting place after we get through the US elections is Europe, especially with the Draghi proposal for an $800 billion a year fiscal stimulus program coming from Brussels, which is really interesting. There's no time period, there's no duration to it. It's not like this is a 10-year thing. $800 billion in order for Europe as an entity to catch up to China and the US. So that makes me very interested in where this goes. And Europe has not been interesting to me for a lot of reasons, but I'm still, you know, enamored with some of the European financials. I still like the Asian financials, you know, but I don't rush out and buy this stuff. And I'm with Peter, I think because of Adam Rosenzweig, who, and what's the piece? He wrote a piece at the end of the second quarter, what is the cost of being early, where Peter is picking up what Adam. So yes, are we early? And early is death to a trader, not death to an investor. So depending upon what hat you're wearing, it's different things, but I'm looking for things. A story that caught my eye the other day, now it hasn't borne any fruit whatsoever yet, but there was a story that Argentina was buying American soybeans because they're so cheap. Now, there's no doubt. Well, Argentina crushes a lot of beans. They provide a lot of soy meal to the world's farmers, those who feed animals. So there's a lot of soy meal. So they're buying American beans because they believe that it's cheap. Now, am I doing anything with that yet? No. You can go to White Wave and look at some of the charts that they'll put out on the bean market. But again, bean prices are low in the U.S. because the United States has had a phenomenal growing season. Phenomenal. So we're going to produce a big crop. But I will warn you, South America, as Adam again and Rosenzweig and Goering write about, they're in drought. They're having some significant water problems, and they're just coming in to their growth, to their planting season. The rivers are low. They're really having some significant, and I think Adam calls it the Gleisberg cycle, which is a cycle of drought that they blame, it's a long-term cycle, and that the American Dust Bowl was a result of the Gleisberg cycle. So things to pay attention with. And I think I'm going to, but if you believe that the United States in an ability to for some resolution of its debt crisis goes to negative real yields again, regardless of what inflation, and that's predicated upon inflation, you're going to want to start seeking some harder assets. And with that is going to be the gamut of commodities. And on a relative basis, commodities are very, very cheap. I mean, the ag stocks have all corrected, as the fertilizers are a giveaway.
I completely agree.
Right? Copper, I mean, everything has had, and the stock company, the equities are far cheaper than the commodities themselves. They've done nothing because there's been far other, the money's poured into other things.
Yeah, that's great. Peter and Ira, how can our listeners learn more about your work, Peter?
So I have a daily commentary on Substack, and they can type in my name, Peter Bukvar, and I named it The Book Report. And as the CIO of a wealth management firm, our website is bleakley.com, and they can read about us there.
Great. Thanks. And Ira?
Find me here, and I'm doing a few others, but and I would advise everybody, get Peter's daily missives in the morning. Well, he writes a couple during the day after data. If you really want to understand the data that comes out, he's an easy, concise read. You might get a little music to it, like with Harley Bassman, who I also have great, you know, but that's from the bond market perspective. But he knows how to poke fun at himself and at the others who we have to do battle with on a daily basis. Get Peter's, you know, it's like, and he's been right on so many things, not only right in words, but right in action, which is the most important element if you're investors. So move some of your funds over to Peter. Me, it's like it'd be duplicating because so much of it, we find ourselves in the same positions. We don't even have to talk to each other. It's really kind of funny.
Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It's been a great, insightful discussion. Thank you, Peter and Ira. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Thank you, Ira.
Thanks for hosting, Richard. This is great as usual. Thanks, Peter.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.